St. Luke's Guide to the Faith, the Church, and the Parish, edited by Richard Kiekeffer, Part 1 by A.K.M. Adam, read by A.K.M. Adam, a disseminary production, disseminary.org. This text brought to you courtesy of St. Luke's Parish, Evanston, Illinois. Chapter 1. Torah and Former Prophets. The Old Testament comprises 39 books of various styles and contents. Long-standing Hebrew tradition divides the Old Testament into three portions: the Pentateuch, otherwise known as the Torah or the Law, the Prophets, Nevi'im, and the Writings, Ketuvim. The second division, the Prophets, can be further divided into the Former Prophets, which are books of accounts about prophets and kings, and the Latter Prophets, which are collections of oracular sayings by prophets. The Torah and the Former Prophets can easily be read as a single connected narrative giving the history of God's people from the creation to the fall of Jerusalem. This chapter will survey these books, and the next chapter will address the latter prophets and the writings. Though one may read the books from Genesis to 2 Kings as a connected history, in a colloquial sense of the word history, they nonetheless include a wide variety of literary styles. While the later portions of the former prophets approximate plain historical writing in its ancient mode, the Torah and the earlier portions of the former prophets include folkloric explanations of where the world comes from and why it goes the way it does. The heart of the Torah is an elaborate collection of rules for the Judaic way of life, and even these vary in style among themselves. Throw in the odd song, riddle, geographic excursus, and readers can recognize the vast difference between the Torah and prophets on one hand, and a contemporary history textbook on the other. Most readers will be familiar with the stories from the first chapters of Genesis: the creation of the world, the creation of the first two human beings and their disobedience, Cain's murder of Abel, the story of Noah's Ark, and the Tower of Babel have entered the common cultural repertoire. These are interspersed with genealogical lists that purport to connect the main characters of the Genesis narratives with the subsequent generations that will found the people of Israel. After the story of the Tower of Babel, Genesis takes a different turn, following the life of a single extended family. In Genesis 12:1-3, God singles out Abram, a resident of Babylon, and calls him to relocate to an undefined region where God will give him and his wife Sarai children, and where God will assign their family an everlasting inheritance. From this point on, the Bible focuses on this family and their lineage, a family that will eventually be named after Abram's grandson Jacob, who earns the new name Israel after a mysterious late-night wrestling match. Genesis follows Abram and Sarai's travels, the birth of their son Isaac, and their renaming to Abraham, father of a multitude, and Sarah, princess, Isaac's betrothal and marriage to Rebekah, the birth of their twin sons, Esau and Jacob, of whom God chooses Jacob, the younger twin, to inherit the Abrahamic promise, Jacob's courtship and his marriages to Leah and Rachel, and his transformation to Israel, Hebrew for he struggles with God, whose 12 sons, led by the 11th son Joseph, prepare for the traditional 12 tribes of Israel. After Genesis establishes the people of Israel as a cultural unit, the book of Exodus narrates their captivity in Egypt and their liberation under the guidance of Moses. Israel's dramatic escape through the Red Sea climaxes in a two-line song that many regard as the most ancient literary unit in the Bible, the Song of Miriam, at Exodus 15:21. As the people make their way in the wilderness of Sinai, Moses relays to them God's commandments for their future way of living. These are summed up in the Ten Commandments and are spelled out at length in the laws enumerated in the second part of Exodus and in Leviticus. The laws themselves take many forms. Some present simple prohibitions or positive injunctions for everyday life. Other laws concern the ritual life of the community, liturgical observances, and the personal conduct requisite for participating in Israel's liturgical life. Other laws present difficult cases and explain the appropriate judgments for those cases. Tradition counts the number of laws as 613, perhaps more than most Christians would wish to live by, but considerably simpler than the U.S. tax code or even local zoning regulations. The Torah ends with the death of Moses on the far side of the Jordan River, before Israel finally enters the land promised to Abraham in Genesis 17. Joshua, Moses' successor, leads the people into the land in the book that bears his name. Though the narration becomes increasingly history-like as Israel begins its pattern of conquests and land division, few, if any, of the events that the conquest narratives describe can be identified directly with incidents that we can verify from archaeology or other ancient sources. In fact, a prominent body of scholars suggests that the entire narrative, from the people's captivity in Egypt to the defeat and exile and reoccupation of Judah, itself constitutes a fictionalized national epic. The motif of conquest and distribution of land continues from the book of Joshua into Judges, where the tribes have begun to settle into the land. In Judges, the Old Testament describes the people living as 12 more or less autonomous tribal groups that come together mainly to fight their common enemies. The fluidity of this political system protected the people from domination by any one tribe or leader, but lacked effective integration that might establish these communities as a single nation. Thus the book of Judges laments, "In those days there was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes," leading to such outrages as the murder of the unnamed concubine described in the last chapters of Judges. In the books of Samuel and Kings, Israel makes the transition from tribal confederation to full-fledged nationhood. 1 Samuel narrates the end of the period of Judges and the calling of Saul to be king. God's prophet Samuel warns the people that kingship would be a bad arrangement. With acute political analysis, he warns that the king will only take the people's sons to fight wars, and their daughters to serve the royal household, the people's land to feed the courtiers, and the people's harvest and goods as taxes. The subsequent history of the kingship confirmed Samuel's prophecy. Even within the reign of Saul, the king began to disregard God's commands and act out of his own sense of statesmanship. When Saul proves unsuitable as king, God instructs Samuel to find another more satisfactory leader for the people. Samuel follows God's command and seeks out the sons of Jesse, among whom God had indicated that he would find a king. When Samuel sees the youngest of Jesse's sons, David, God selects him as the successor to be. In the interval, David becomes a soldier of fortune, sometimes leading his band of mercenaries against Israel's enemies, sometimes working on behalf of Israel's enemies. He and his troops offer protection to the people of the region in exchange for food and material support. All this while, Saul has sunk into deeper and deeper despair. Though at first he loved and trusted David to the point of arranging David's marriage to Saul's daughter Michal, the younger man's military successes and popular support alienate Saul from David. When Saul and his son Jonathan fall in battle against the Philistines, David assumes command of the armies of Israel and is recognized as king. Though David stands in the Bible's records as the prototypical good king, he captured the city of the Jebusites, renamed it Jerusalem, and established his capital there, and he seems to have extended the territory of the people of Israel to the north and to the east. His reign is not unproblematic. His proclivity to accumulate wives and concubines complicates his family politics. He takes Bathsheba, a married woman, so that he might have her sexually. When she becomes pregnant, David arranges the murder of her husband Uriah the Hittite. The prophet Nathan conveys to David God's anger at this high-handed conduct. Bathsheba's child dies at birth, and David's reign concludes with one tragedy after another. One of his sons, Amnon, rapes Tamar, one of his daughters. Another son, Absalom, starts a rebellion against him. A rival claimant to the throne tries to displace David in the aftermath of Absalom's rebellion. In David's old age, his son Adonijah prematurely declares himself to be king. As one of his last acts, David confirms that he wants Bathsheba's son Solomon to inherit the throne. Solomon has taken on a great reputation for wisdom. In a well-known scene, God appears to Solomon in a dream and offers him anything he might ask for. Solomon humbly asks only for an understanding mind, which pleases God so much that God gives him understanding and great riches and power also. Solomon's wisdom was not, however, immediately apparent in his statesmanship. While he built a splendid temple for the Lord in Jerusalem, he also built palaces and fortresses and did not pay his foreign debts in full. He married many foreign wives, whom he permitted to establish shrines for their gods. Indeed, he even joined them in worshipping these gods. He formed a centralized bureaucracy in Jerusalem to the discontent of his subjects in outlying regions. In all these policies, Solomon showed himself less than fully wise and set the stage for his successors' unhappy reigns. Solomon's son Rehoboam took the throne at his father's death and moved rapidly to increase taxes to support even greater luxury at the court. 10 of the tribal regions refused to pay the additional assessments and withdrew from the kingdom. From then on, the tribes of the north formed a kingdom called Israel, based in Shechem, eventually at Samaria, with worship centers in Bethel and Dan. The southern kingdom, representing only the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, was known as Judah during the period of the divided kingdoms. The Bible records the kings of Israel as an unbroken chain of idolaters and tyrants. More because the northern kingdom had rebelled against the Davidic king and refused to worship in Jerusalem than because of any intrinsic immorality. By the same token, the kings of Judah, though they often seem to have tolerated idolatry and general malfeasance, receive a more positive evaluation because of their Davidic ancestry and their support of the Jerusalem temple. After a series of border conflicts with various rival kingdoms, Israel was conquered in 722 BCE by Assyrian armies under Sargon. The kingdom of Judah endured another 135 years, sometimes as a vassal state to Egypt, sometimes vassal to Babylon, but was decisively conquered by Babylonian invaders under Nebuchadrezzar in 587. Here, 2 Kings ends, and with it the books of the former prophets. The rightful king of Judah, Jehoiachin, endured decades in a Babylonian prison, finally being released by Nebuchadnezzar's successor, Evil-Merodach. But the nobles of Judah would not be permitted to return to Jerusalem until the year 538. This has been Chapter 1 of St. Luke's Guide to the Faith, the Church, and the Parish, edited by Richard Kiekeffer, Part 1 by A.K.M. Adam, read by A.K.M. Adam, a Disseminary production, disseminary.org. This text brought to you courtesy of St. Luke's Parish, Evanston, Illinois. Copyright 2005 by the Disseminary, distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike license.